change the world, change the world.
Oh, yes, we can.
We can change the world, we can change the world, change the world.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. It's a joy to be with you today on this Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. I'm Santita Jackson. Wow. California. Coming to you from WCPT, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, AM 950 Radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota. I want to hear your thoughts on California last night. That's right. Holy, saved us last night, everybody. 773-763-9278-773-763 WCPT, if you want to text, just F that number. GWC Injury Lawyers gives you the opportunity to do that. But I want to hear your thoughts. I want to hear your voices today. Linear Bob and Carol, did you expect this result? Because last month, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, who won by almost 62% just three years ago, he was in trouble. That's why you got Kamala Harris, the vice president, out there. That's why you got Joe Biden, the president, out there. That's why you got, I mean, they brought Elizabeth Warren. I mean, they brought out the big guns. You saw Maxine Waters traveling the state because they really needed to move people around. And in fact, even, I mean, he got a big chunk of the, well, should I say an excited Latinx vote. But he got the overwhelming majority of the black vote. And that's a story that is being undertold, underplayed. So, but he had a rainbow, and that saved him. But also Larry Elder, the conservative talk radio host, not a beloved figure. I wonder how much that played into it. So I want to hear what you think about what happened in California and what it means for the rest of the country, as we're seeing rollbacks on voting rights, rollbacks on reproductive rights. There's a lot going on. So please call me or text me at 773-763-9278, 773-763 WCPT. And today we're going to be talking about schools. Okay, now we've been back in school for 1, 2, 3 weeks. What is it looking like? I was inspired by Dr. Marnie Reeves because she was very, very upset yesterday. She, of course, teaches in New York City in their public school system, as well as she's a professor in the university system as well. But she said, these people are not ready. I mean, and then we read the stories in Chicago. It doesn't appear that Chicago's ready. It doesn't appear that there is that the systems, the public school systems, were ready for our kids all the way around. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. And what recourse do parents have? Do children have? Do teachers have? It's a lot. And then we're going to be talking about California and where the Democrats go from here. We see President Biden struggling with his numbers, struggling to stay above water. He's had a really tough go of it over the past couple of months. Where will he go from here? You tell me. Where the Democrats go and how they can work this out, because now we're moving into the 2022 and then the 2024 season. You know, what will the Democrats be able to hold on to the House of Representatives, the Senate? Will they? Call me 773-763-9278, 773-763 WCPT. Let's go to some of these headlines so that we can get to some good news from Pastor Vicki Johnson. Chicago will have a high of 74 degrees. It's sunny today. Minneapolis, St. Paul, a high of 77 degrees, mostly sunny. The Dow closed down 292 points yesterday. The NASDAQ closed down 67 points. The S&P 500 closed down 25 points. In Major League Baseball, well, we had a clean sweep, if you will. The Twins, 6, Cleveland, 3. The Cubs, 6, Phillies, 3, the White Sox, 9, the Angels, 3. Good for them. Everybody, what happened in California? Well, Gavin Newsom came out on top resoundingly. 3 years ago, he won by 61.9% and won by 65% this time. It was 64%. Should he be recalled? 64% said no, keep him. 35.8% said, you know, replace him. And of those who could replace him, Larry Elder pulled up 46% of the vote. And it wasn't even close for anyone else. And many people are now saying that this is now the party of Larry Elder in California. What will that mean? How far will he take, how far to the right will he take the party? He had a very gracious concession speech yesterday, calling Gavin Newsom, the governor, and saying, hey, we've got to, you know, accept this defeat. Graciously, he doubled back and said, hey, but, you know, we might have lost this battle, but we will not lose the war. But he did not stir up, I should say, the devils in people, not the lesser angels. There's no such thing, everybody. Coronavirus. 1 in 500 Americans have died from coronavirus since the nation first reported infection. The math is there, according to this CNN report. 663,000 U.S. deaths as of Tuesday night. A U.S. population of 331 million as of April 2020, while we're talking numbers, they say the Kaiser Family Foundation estimates that the preventable cost for treating hospitalized unvaccinated COVID-19 patients was roughly $5.7 billion. But I have a question for you, everybody. What about those who present themselves to the hospital but cannot get medicine? I keep talking to you about therapeutics. We need to ask those questions, too. General Mark Milley, President Trump's top military advisor. Well, it's being reported in a book by Bob Woodward that he single-handedly took secret action to limit then-President Trump from potentially ordering a dangerous military strike or launching nuclear weapons after the January 6th attack on the Capitol. This is according to this book, Peril, by Bob Woodward and veteran Washington Post reporter Robert Costa. They write that Milley was certain that Trump had gone into a serious mental decline in the aftermath of the election. I'd like to hear all sides of that. That is a fascinating take, everybody. What do you think about that? Do you believe it? Do you believe it? Wow. It just gets more stunning every day. American household income fell in 2020, the first decline since 2011. The median household income decreased 2.9% to $67,500 between 2019 and 2020. In the meantime, we saw an increase in inflation, 5.3%. Sad news from the world of comedy. Norm Macdonald, for those of us who are all who've been Saturday Night Live fans, the brilliant comedian with his almost laconic delivery, never broke a smile. Well, we did not know that he had been waging a 10-year battle with cancer, and he finally succumbed to it. He was 61, but he left behind a brilliant body of work. According to sources, NBA players will not be required to get the COVID-19 vaccination. I have got to find out why. You know, because black people have been very resistant to getting these shots. So do you think that's part of it, that they don't want to lose their workforce? In the meantime, this is kind of interesting. Pastor Vicki Johnson, did you know that the Brookfield Zoo is rolling out a vaccine program for animals? Yeah, for at risk for COVID-19. You can't make this stuff up. You cannot make this stuff up. In the meantime, in Washington, D.C., they are going door to door to get people to get their vaccines, to get these shots. Silence, Pastor Johnson?
Yes, complete silence.
They are going door to door. They said, if you don't come in, and they will go by your home multiple times. You know, because there is a listing of everyone who's taken one of these shots. It is recorded. It is recorded. Oh, boy, being on talk radio at this time is a gift. It's a gift. There's so much to talk about. Pastor Vicki Johnson. Brilliant psalmist and the pastor of the St. Thomas Lutheran Church, where they are holding outdoor services from 11:45 to 12:15 at 80th and Jeffrey on Sundays. You don't want to miss it. Pastor Vicki Johnson, what's the good news?
Good morning, Santita, to all your morning stars and friends. There is good news today, despite everything that you've given us already. There is a song that was written by Fats Domino's brother-in-law, Reginald Hall, and it was recorded by Joe Jones after Fats passed on it. The title of the song was, You Talk Too Much.
Oh.
It describes, do you remember that?
Yeah, well, I don't remember it, but you know my parents do.
Yeah, yeah, and you probably heard it at some point.
Absolutely.
Yes. It describes a loquacious person. It says, you talk about people wherever you go. You talk about people you don't even know. You just talk.
You talk too much.
Much. See, I told you you know it.
You know I do.
Right now, we are on Progressive Talk Radio, where talk is the order of the day. But our host is very careful to tap into brilliant minds like Dr. Deb, also known as Glamma, and all other guests who are experts in their fields to only talk about what they know or can intelligently speak on. James, the third chapter, reprimands us because just like that song, at some point or another, we talk too much. Whenever you are not speaking the truth, you are talking too much. Anytime your words are hurtful or harmful to your sisters and to your brothers, and even to the people that you don't like, you talk too much. If your words are not being used to bless, heal, and prosper, you are talking too much. My challenge today is to think before you speak. You can apologize for what you say after you've said it, but you cannot take your words back. The mouth is so hard to control. What can be done? I say that we can think, then speak. I can remember my daddy telling me, think before you speak. Yes, and then no one will have to make you the subject of a song that was written 60 years ago. Your words have power, so use them wisely. And if you can do this, and I'm sure that you can, then to me, that's good news.
Amen. You got this song playing in my head right now. You talk too much. Oh, man. Oh, wow. And you know what? We have been admonished as children, taught and then admonished. Think before you speak. And that's why, you know, when people have irritated me or angered me, I step back. Because I don't want to say something that, you know, that I will regret for the rest of my life. You know?
Yes.
My father calls it diarrhea of the mouth.
Diarrhea of the mouth.
Shut up.
And something is bound to come out that you don't want to come back or that you wish you hadn't said. Yeah.
It is an illness. So just keep your mouth shut, really. And just because, you know, in time it dissipates. In time it dissipates. Pastor Vicki Johnson, just very quickly, how are your outdoor services going?
They're going very well. The people that feel comfortable being present are present. We are masked and sitting apart from each other, but enjoying being in God's beautiful nature. The weather has cooperated almost every single Sunday that we've been out there, and it's just such a blessing to be able to gather after last year when we couldn't.
Well, you know, and you're doing it safely. Stay right here. We've got Dr. Deborah Furholden on before we start talking about what's happening in the schools. But Dr. Deborah Furholden, epidemiologist, associate dean of public health at Michigan State University, Glamma, as you pointed out, Pastor Johnson. You know, I just came across this information just before I came on the air. You know, this lets you know just how everybody's allowed to make their own rules in a pandemic, which doesn't sound right to me. Dr. Deborah Verholden. The NBA is going to allow the players to play unvaccinated. Now, the NFL is requiring that, you know, people get the shots. But in the NBA, not so much. And you've seen, you know, the absolute resistance to these shots by black people. Do you think that's the reason? Or what do you think it is? I mean, because they certainly do have contact with each other. They certainly are breathing heavily. Dr. Deb?
Sorry, I lost you for just a sec. So okay. This is an interesting repeat. We saw this with the Olympics. I was so shocked that so many Olympic athletes were able to go to the Olympics unvaccinated, not like for their own protection, right? And, you know, playing in the Olympics is such a privilege. You know, it's one that people really work hard to acquire, but no one's entitled to that. There's no law that says every single great athlete is entitled to a shot at the Olympics or a seat on the squad, right? So in some ways, it's like a very hard to earn privilege, but it's a privilege, right? It's not an entitlement. And playing in the NFL and playing in the NBA, I think, are no exceptions. And so, you know, when you hear these things, and this is, again, go back to my point about equity. When you start cherry picking people and populations and occupations and all of that and put those mandates in, I just worry that we're going to further inequity. So I can't even imagine what's underneath, because I always say you got to follow the money and you got to follow who has the power. I can't imagine what forces are at play in those different franchises that would have one franchise go one way and another franchise go another way. But I doubt it's about what the players want, because the reality of it is most of those players will not have the kinds of opportunities to have the kind of status and income and opportunity that they have without those franchises. So if they mandated it, what would happen if most of them would get vaccinated? I doubt that they would walk off the field or walk off the court.
But you know what, these
some other things that play there.
But and remember, they also are high privilege. They were able to get tested when the rest of Americans, and certainly black Americans, couldn't get tested. Remember that? Because that was the pushback last year, that professional athletes were getting tested and, you know, black people and brown people were looking for tests. But also, I'm wondering, Dr. Deb, if they do get COVID, if they contract it, and it's out here, they would get the therapeutics that I've been talking about, right? I mean, the governor of Texas is fully, he's gotten all his shots, fully vaccinated, if you will. And guess what? They gave him Regeneron. He was barely symptomatic, but he was able to get treatment. And that, to me, is a real issue, Dr. Deb. People get COVID, but then they're not getting treatment. Attorney Hoffler has a client, a child, a 17-year-old, who was denied treatment. He presented himself to the hospital 3 times. It was on the 3rd time that he died. He had not been treated for COVID. Only heaven knows what would have happened if he'd gotten the treatment when he was presented the first time when his parents took him. So I'm wondering, you know, it seems to me that there are a lot of pieces that are moving. But just also very quickly, in Washington, D.C., your home, they are now going to start going door to door to get people to get their vaccines. And they said that they will go multiple times throughout the day, because if you are on Medicare, you know, they are like, okay, it's open season on you. So what do you think about that? How is that going to work?
Well, I've been saying for a long time the strategy that we need to use, and I actually wrote a really great article about it, but I just couldn't get published. I couldn't even get a local paper to see the brilliance in this, was the door-to-door. And I was saying it's even more than door-to-door, because the pushback that people give you on door-to-door is they say, well, people don't need you to bring it to them. It's readily available and it's readily accessible in community. But the door-to-door wasn't just about the transportation. It was also, what we're finding is when the people who are a no or maybe so or I'm not sure or not yet, for many of those people, what they're looking for is some assurances. They're looking for really good knowledge and information that they can trust, you know, to get off the fence or to jump on the other side of the fence. You know, for a lot of people, they've got to be walked through that, not forced, but walked and talked through it. So I've been advocating for a long time for door-to-door, church-to-church, cookout-to-cookout, open-house-to-open-house. If you can actually meet people where they are in safe spaces and have conversations with them using trusted, credible messengers where people are provided information and can make a choice, I think we'd see a lot more progress than we've seen in just mass vaccination sites, putting it out in community, and now this attempt to sort of force it into people's arms. We are going to get more people vaccinated with these mandates. I have no doubt about that. But we are also going to have some people who are going to dig their heels in deeper. Their mistrust is only going to deepen. And any negative impacts that come out of it are going to give way to all kinds of lawsuits. And those things will get much more media attention than the average Joe who got vaccinated, contracted COVID and didn't really get too sick, or was a, you know, in the midst of a COVID outbreak and didn't contract COVID. That doesn't make headlines. No one wants to read about that. That's not exciting. They want to read about the stories like the one Nicki Minaj posted, where someone got vaccinated and then one of their testicles, you know, enlarged and their fiance left them. I mean, it's just the sensationalism. And I love how Pastor Johnson said it. And Pastor Johnson, just so you know, that message is, it carries through. There was a song of my generation by a group called Run DMC, and it was called You Talk Too Much. But theirs was the new version of Mr. Collins' version, and there said, you talk too much, you never shut up.
Never shut up.
I remember that. Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's
right there.
You got now. You know, people are talking, but they're not speaking the things that are empowering the people. And my thing is, it's not about convincing people to get the vaccine, because I don't think you need to be doing that either. But I've been surprised, even at a university. I'm in a college of human medicine. I'm in a college of medicine. And so many people here even say they don't have access to the type of information, the conversations that they would need to powerfully be a yes or a no, so they remain on the fence.
They don't. They do not have access to credible messengers, and also we don't have access to a free flowing conversation on vaccine injury. That has happened too. If we had an open conversation, you would have a you would have a trusting environment. We don't have that right now. We can't talk. We are not allowed to ask questions. That is a problem. While you got a pandemic out here, a pandemic. Trust me, I knew it. It came home for me and my family. I get it. You know, but I also know that we need access not only to the vaccines, but you need access to the therapeutics. We need access to Medicare for all. You got to have some real questions here about our health. Let's talk about what's happening in these schools, everybody. Were they ready to receive everybody who works in there, all the kids who learn there? I don't know. Back in just a minute.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Santita Jackson Show. WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, and AM 950 radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota. They are my homes, along with my Facebook family, the Santita Jackson Morning Stars. Paul, if you could bring me down just a bit, they're saying they're hearing some crackling. We're working on this, everybody, working on this every day. I want you to meet the Morning Stars on the Santita Jackson and Friends page. Carol from the Left Coast and Linear Bob, who was with me first thing this morning, letting me know that they did the thing out in California. Dave Dowling, our brother to the north in Canada, Jewel and Joyce and Lorraine and L Truth, though for sure. And let me see, Lewis and Carissa and all of you. Sending you much love, Linda, Dawn, Sending you much, much, much love today. I want you to call me at 773-763-9278. And let's talk about the California recall at the top of the hour. But right now, let's talk about what's happening in our schools. The headlines are here from The Guardian. Chicago public school students return amid bus shortage and safety concerns. You know, we've lost a lot of bus drivers because they refuse to submit to the vaccine mandate. Crowded New York City schools. This is from the New York Daily News. Experiment with new schedules, spaces, and furniture arrangements to keep 3 feet of distance. Is it working? Dilapidated buildings, according to Truth Out. Wonderful piece. Increased risk of COVID transmission as the school year begins. And they start off with a story of a third grader, Sarah Atkins, out in Norridge, Illinois. She knew that she'd be facing a slew of challenges, none of them related to curriculum or student achievement. First would be hot in the building. Secondly, the water fountain would be inoperable because they'd been turned off to protect against possible lead poisoning, another issue. And then COVID. Nothing in the schools really has changed since the pandemic began. And yet everybody's going back. We have got a tremendous panel to talk about this today. Dr. Deb is still with us. She said she wants to talk about this today. Of course, she's about to send her baby to school in about 2-3 years, her grandbaby, of course. And then, but she's an epidemiologist, so she understands what the policy ought to be. Public health. We've got Dr. Shanina Knighton, infection preventionist, registered nurse, scholar at Case Western Reserve University. What should we be doing? What should they be doing in these classrooms in the schools? This is inspired by Dr. Marnie Reeves, professor at the City University of New York and a teacher in the New York City public school system, and Christine Pledger, teacher of 30 years plus here in the Chicago Public Schools. She loves her children. You have not lived until you have seen her dressed up as Snow White. She just loves it, loves it, loves it. Let me start with you, Dr. Reeves. You were quite disturbed yesterday by what you have seen. Before I, you know, kind of move this conversation around, what are you seeing in New York in the classrooms, in the schools?
Chaos.
You're also prominent in the unions as well.
I'm seeing nothing but chaos. It's chaotic. It's been 2 days of nothing but disorganization. Our first day coming back, our screening system, our health screening system went down through the DOE. So the kids had to come in, staff had to come in and fill out paper instead of doing their screenings online. The screenings are supposed to be done from home so that if, you know, you have symptoms or if one of the questions that you're responding to is a yes, when it should be a no, you don't bother to come in. Well, we had long lines wrapped around the school buildings throughout New York because the system went down. We have people who are resigning from their position. They're just not going to deal with it. After the first day, we had so many. We had teachers as well as school aides and paraprofessionals who have resigned. They turned in their resignations on Monday. Yesterday, we thought it would be better. It's not. We're now 3 days in with students in the building. I just walked through a crowd of students who, again, came in today because they said they didn't get information from the DOE, the New York City DOE, you know, regarding registration, vaccinations, all that stuff. So it's a lot of misinformation, lack of communication. It's just chaotic, poor planning. They had 2 years, okay, and I say 2 years because realistically for us, you have a whole summer that equals about 4 months in a school year. So all this time, they were supposed to be putting things in place. They never bothered to do it. On the surface, yes, in news conferences, we've heard the mayor say, oh, we're ready. We are definitely not ready to have kids back in schools in New York City. Definitely not ready.
Unbelievable. Christine Pledger, what are you seeing in Chicago?
Well, I'm listening, and I'm hearing in New York, at least they have health screeners. We no longer have that. We are back in school as if a pandemic never happened. There's no health screeners. There's no temperature check. We haven't even had COVID tests. There's no social distancing. I have friends who have reported 40 children in the classroom, all types of behaviors occurring. Kids are out of control, and administration is doing nothing because they don't have to. So at least you guys are attempting to follow some type of safety protocols. Not so much here in Chicago. They threw the health screeners out of the window. It's 3 feet distancing when available, when you're able. But other than that, it's up to each individual school or principal to make sure that all these things are put in place. But if they aren't able to do it, there's no there's nothing that parents or teachers can do about it. The only thing that we have in place are we do still have to wear masks. But that's about it. There's nothing else.
But you said there are no temperature checks. No temperature checks.
There's no temperature checks. There's no. We had a health screener. Teachers, students, before you got to school or once you got there, you had to go online and complete a health screener. We've had classrooms closing down. The first week of school, we've had classrooms all over the city that closed down. And if you look to check, there's no documentation. There's no record of it. So they're kind of like keeping it undercover. Whenever a classroom has to be closed because due to COVID, they are keeping that under wraps. So there's no way, unless you know somebody at the school, you don't know that your child's school has any type of COVID outbreak. And there's no contact tracing either. You know, they promised to hire more, but as of right now, I have friends whose kids have been sitting home due to COVID, and they have not been contacted. So it's just one of those things where Chicago really does not have any true leadership right now. So we are really just out there. This organization is like that is what we're looking at. Totally disorganized, totally not respecting our safety. Children or teachers.
We're talking with Christine Pledger, Chicago public school teacher for more than 30 years. Dr. Marnie Reeves, been in the New York City public schools. Indeed, she is, you're a steward in the union, yes?
I am a chapter leader in the union.
Chapter leader. So help me with this. Before I go to you, Dr. Knighton, wait a minute. Just stay right there. Dr. Knighton. No health screeners in the Chicago public schools. So what does that sound like to you? Dr. Knighton? Well, let me go to you, Dr. Deb. What does that sound like to you? I mean, no screeners? No temperature checks? None of that?
Well, the sad thing is we've taken, again, the very basic things that work, and we are getting rid of them. You know, this is a simple analogy. If you put bread in the toaster and nothing happens, you got to plug the toaster back into the power source. The power source that we had that helped us to flatten the curve was prevention. And it's sad because we know exactly what it will take. I love this example that the CDC provided for us of the teacher who was reading to her class and decided to unmask while she read to the class. Not realizing that she had COVID, she infected every human being in the front row and about half the people in the second row and a couple people in the third row that she was reading to. Now, I have no doubt that that teacher did not mean no student harm. And if she had known she had COVID, that she would have done something differently, probably even likely having stayed home, definitely wouldn't have taken her mask off. But this is the thing about COVID-19. We don't know who has it and who doesn't early on. You know, when most people are spreading the virus, they don't have symptoms, or they have symptoms and they mistake it for other things like allergies, you know, or they say, oh, I'm just a little tired. No, you got the beginning of the fatigue that comes with this virus, you know. And so I agree with Dr. Reed. We had a lot of time to prepare for this, and we missed the opportunity to do the preparation. You know how many schools don't have moving air? We had that problem right here in my own school district. The schools don't have moving air. They don't have air handling systems, or the air handling systems that they have are so old and outdated, they're not in use. So teachers have to crack windows or open windows, many of which don't even have filters or screens in them. And they put a fan in just to have some air in the classroom moving. We missed the opportunity to improve upon our schools. We missed the opportunity. If y'all wanted all the bus drivers vaccinated, where was the outreach campaign to sit down with these bus drivers, to meet with their unions, to meet with them door to door before it was time to go back to school and say, well, y'all can't come back if you're not vaccinated. And then say, well, I'll go find another job then. You know, it's just it's poor planning, it's poor preparation. But there's so much money circulating right now during this crisis. We aren't making investments. We're just throwing money at short term solutions and not making long term investments.
Sure. I mean, it sounds like real gangster, you know, and that to me is what's that's what's problematic because.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can hear you, Dr. Knighton. I mean, what are you? No health screeners in the schools. This is what Christine Pledger, veteran, and just a wonderful teacher. I mean, every time you talk to Christine, even if it's just on a personal level, all she can talk about are her kids. These are her children. This is what they are her children. Dr. Reeves is the same way. Dr. Reeves even has a van. She doesn't need a van at this point in her life. She has a van so she can get her children around, to get them to plays in New York, to get them to see all that that city and the world has to offer. I mean, these people give their lives. They don't teach for a living. They live to teach. No health screenings in a public school system? I mean, that sounds
crazy. They never had them in place. Like, that's the one thing we have to realize is that when the pandemic happened and everyone was sent home for a couple of weeks and then for the remainder of the year, nothing was put in place. And so what we're looking at right now is the concern that I had, that I told people, written guidelines does not equal practice. And the problem is you had people that were saying, oh, everyone's going to mask when they come to school and clean their hands. And they have not been doing walkthroughs. They have not been practicing on a routine basis to make sure that their protocols are working. So when things hit the fan, it's, oh, my gosh, we now have an increase in cases because we're realizing that we were not taking all of the safety protocols that we possibly could. And even, too, you know, when I was talking to Dr. Reeves not too long ago, teachers being able to check when they have a full-capacity classroom because they can't socially distance, there should be a CO2 reader in the school. Is there enough air exchange while the teacher is in there teaching between the teacher and the student? Because right now we understand that just like educators can be carriers, children can be carriers as well. I also asked if it was my classroom, I would have a bottle of hand sanitizer at the door, and every person that comes inside of my class would be cleaning their hands as they're going inside of the classroom. So even if the school felt like, hey, they're going to be negligent with their checks, I would make sure that as an educator, I have my own checks outlined in my own classroom to ensure my own safety. Because just as you mentioned, Santita, these teachers live to teach, but they are also mothers, their grandmothers, their aunties, their cousins, their daughters to someone else. And they also want to be safe when they're going home to those individuals. And so that would be my recommendation. But I've always said that if you are not practicing through simulation or practicing in real life and constantly reevaluating your protocols, even buffering in sick days to make sure that you can have individuals come in, then it's not okay. I've said that to the parents, too. I want to know where my kid is going to be at throughout the school day, which is actually something I do even to this day. The school has, they close school once a month or once every couple of weeks. And so right now it's been once every couple of weeks just to reevaluate their protocols. But I want to know where my kid's going to be moving throughout the day. I want to know how recess looks. I want to know everything because I want to make sure that even though I'm sharing with them safety protocols, that the education setting that they're in is also keeping them safe. And unfortunately, we already knew that when it came down to school nurses reporting pink eye, reporting a GI virus, reporting anything. They were already delayed vaccine because it's only likely one school nurse, sometimes for half the district. So we already had a deficit there. And so the reporting mechanism for both faculty or teachers as well as students was already lacking when it came to the spread of germs and illnesses even before the pandemic. So this is just a reflection that when we talk about our government dollars, they are not prioritizing education, which has always been an issue, which is why there is a lack of equity across the board when it comes to our system.
C.K. Hoffler, Attorney C.K. Hoffler, who's accountable? Who bears responsibility for this? I mean, for not having health screeners in the schools. If the children get sick, you know, most people in America are struggling financially. You can get the vaccine. You can get the shots. But you know what costs you to recover? And oftentimes it costs you a lot of money to recover from COVID. It does. So who is responsible? Who's responsible if these children take this home to their parents who can't afford to take off time from work or who can't work remotely? I mean, all these scenarios are working out in my mind, and I know everyone, these are playing out in your mind too. Who's responsible here? CK.
Well, good morning, Santita, and to our panel as well. You know, the responsibility, I think, is shared by many. I think the school systems, whether it's the Chicago school systems, the New York school systems, or Atlanta school systems, have to take some responsibility because they had ample time to plan for this. In most school systems over the past 18 months or 16 months, the children were learning virtually. The schools recognized the problems. The schools actually knew that that the water was problematic, that they had lead pipes, that they had air conditioning systems that weren't working, that the classrooms, they knew the number of students to expect, that the classrooms are going to be packed. All of these things were foreseeable. These are not new issues. They were issues that existed before COVID. So in my impression, one group that is responsible is really the school systems, because they had notice, they had time, and they had the ability to try to address some of these issues. And I'm not minimizing the fact that there are a lot of constraints administratively, red tape-wise, to addressing these issues, but I do think the school systems are at issue. They knew the children were coming into the classrooms. They knew over the summer they could have done simulations. They could have done tests. They could have done so many things with the school teachers. So I think, one, the school system. Secondly, I do think that the state governments as well bear some of the blame. When you have governors throughout the country who are not imposing mask mandates or who, in fact, are saying that there should not be any mask and making COVID a political issue versus treating it as a medical crisis and pandemic, where our children are the most exposed because they don't have the option of being vaccinated, even if their families wanted them to be vaccinated. And the CDC is saying that vaccinations and wearing masks and social distancing and observing the protocols those are the things that will flatten the curve. Then we have tied the hands when you have governors who are making such pronouncements as there should be no masks of those who really truly want to protect the children. So I think we have to look to state government. Finally, I think we have to look to the federal government. I think President Biden has been very aggressive in putting in place a COVID policy. I know there are monies that are available to the schools. That money has not, for some reason, trickled down to the schools. So bureaucracy also is part of the problem. But I think the greatest blame I put are in the school systems themselves, because they've had a long time to try to figure this out. They knew what monies would be required. They knew that they had dilapidated buildings. There could have been a crisis management, and it's not the best scenario, but there are some schools that had trailers or other temporary structures to put some of the kids, the overflow kids, so that you wouldn't have 40 students packed in a room. And so I think those are the strongest people who have responsibility. And there's going to be litigation as well. It really is not mattering from people that there are shields to litigation, or some of the entities who could be responsible might be immune. People are going to sue because this involves the safety of our children. I mean, our children, who are the most vulnerable population in this country, in any country, are the children. And they don't even have a chance when they can't observe the proper protocols. And I think that the teacher unions have to be very, very careful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're taking strong positions on certain things. And I question whether they're really protecting the teachers. And I'm just going to say it. And it varies from state to state, but I do believe that that's another group that has to really, really sit back and look at their actions.
I think so. I mean, Dr. Deb, you know, we're going to have to, you know, really revisit this conversation and have a longer one. Dr. Deb, where do we go in terms of policy? I've got about 2 minutes here. Because last year, without the vaccines, without the shots, you were excited about the fact that we were beginning to flatten the curve. You said we are making progress. People are being hygienic. We're washing our hands properly. We're wearing the masks and we're bringing the numbers down. We did that without a vaccine. What should the policy be now?
I like the way Attorney Hoffner framed it. I always say the fish stinks from the head. So I actually take issue with the fact that the federal government has yet to issue a federal mask mandate. You know, these vaccine mandates that are coming out are going to be very hard to enforce. They're not universal. It's cherry-picked, so they're creating potentially further inequity by targeting certain occupations or certain groups, you know. And I understand, you know, legally why Congress is exempt. Right. I understand that that's a different branch of government, et cetera. But, you know, our federal government, both our leading executives and our leading legislators, to me, have dropped the ball. Because what's happening in communities is this. My health commissioner issued a mask mandate for all K-6. She then later expanded it from K-12. And she got death threats, like credible death threats that resulted in an arrest of a human being who got her home address, made some threats, did some things to carry through on that threat. And my question is, where's our governor? You know, we had about half of our counties issued these mandates. Our county went first, and then within the 48 hours that followed, about, you know, another 40 or so counties in Michigan came on board. You know, this has to come from higher up, because if you think about it, the governor has at her disposal the Department of Health and Human Services, the State Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They've got epidemiologists. They've got all of this. Most school systems don't have all that stuff. They don't. We put kids in schools and we act as if the primary goal is to get them educated. But our kids got to be educated. They need occupational therapy. They need emotional and behavioral supports. They got to deal with the physical conditions that they face, many of them just getting to school. You know, about half of inner city schools report feeling unsafe on the route from home to school, whether it be walking or busing. School systems are just being asked to solve all these problems that they're not resourced to solve.
But
so
you
I
know
think
what?
We need a higher level policy and then the backing it up with resources at the school system level.
Absolutely. I mean, and we're all going to have to come together. Let me tell you something. Parents, you can't just put your child at the school door and leave them there. You got to be involved. Teachers, you've got to get involved in your unions. We have to get registered to vote. We have to press our elected officials who work for us to make this right. No one should be unsafe in a school building on a campus. Children, teachers, everyone. I've got to head on out to break. But, you know, I promise you, we will come back and talk about this. Whenever you know, whenever I start talking, that means I'm looking at the clock. I'm up against it.
Yeah.
But stay right here on Facebook Live. I'm going to let you all talk for about a minute, and then I'm going to have to clear the decks because we're going to be talking about Gavin Newsom. And the California recall, what does that mean? And as we're looking at President Biden's numbers, he's struggling in terms of popularity. So even though he and Vice President Harris went out there, I wonder how much they helped. Well, whatever it is, Gavin Newsom, who won office by 61.9% of the vote, he got 64% yesterday. So it was a rousing mandate. What is going on, everybody? What does this mean for politics in the United States? Back in just a minute.
We can change the world. Change the world.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Santita Jackson Show, WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station. I'm Santita Jackson. It's a joy to be with you on Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. I want to hear your voices today. 773-763-9278, 773-763-WCPT. If you want to text me, GWC Injury Lawyers gives you the opportunity to do that. But I want to hear your voices today. What do you think about what happened in California yesterday? What happened in California yesterday? Well, last month, it looked like Gavin Newsom, the governor, who won 3 years ago by with 61.9% of the vote, looked like he was going to lose. But it turns out he won going away. What happened? Did he change his position? Was it Larry Elder? Did people just not like the opposition? There's just a whole lot going on out there. So I've got a stellar panel to talk with all of you about this. And I want to hear your thoughts. What does this portend for American politics? I mean, what does this mean for 2022? What does it mean for 2024? Because whatever happened last night, you do know that the Republicans are organizing. Now, that's what we got a chance to see. That is what we got a chance to see. There are only about 24% of the registered voters in California, and yet they almost toppled. At least they were able to get a force of recall election. They almost toppled a sitting governor. Something to think about. 773-763-9278. Let's get to some of these headlines, Paul. Chicago, we're going to have a high of 74 degrees today. Nice and cool, sunny, though. And Minneapolis, St. Paul, 77 degrees, mostly sunny. The Dow closed down 292 points yesterday. The NASDAQ closed down 67 points. The S&P 500 closed down 25 points. In Major League Baseball, the Twins were triumphant over Cleveland, 6-3. The Cubs were triumphant over the Phillies, 6-3. And wow, the White Sox, 9. The Angels, 3. Gavin Newsom will remain the governor. We're going to talk about that in a hot second. What will all of that mean, everybody? What will all of that mean? 64% of the vote, excuse me, and counting. We still don't know what the final count is. So everybody, we're going to be talking about that California recall in a hot second. The coronavirus, 1 in 500 Americans have died from COVID, from the coronavirus, since the nation's first reported infection. 663,000 deaths. That is from CNN. Wow, 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 everybody. Governor Mark Milley, President Trump's top military advisor, according to a new book by Washington Post legend Bob Woodward and veteran Washington Post reporter Robert Costa. The new book is called Peril. Well, they said that he single-handedly took secret action to limit President Trump from potentially ordering a dangerous military strike or launching nuclear weapons after the January 6th attack. They write in this book that Milley, quote, was certain that Trump had gone into a serious mental decline, excuse me, in the aftermath of the election, quote, close quote, and called a secret meeting in his Pentagon office on January 8th to review the process for military action. That is incredible news, everybody. What do you think about that? What do you think about that? Well, I think we have to find out the whole story. How about that? American household income fell in 2020, the first decline since 2011, according to the U.S. Census. Amidst that, guess what? We saw a rise in inflation, 5.3%. We're going to have Dr. Julianne Malvo to come back and talk to us about that. What does that mean when your income falls and inflation spikes? Norm Macdonald, legendary comedian, famous for his stint on Saturday Night Live, was in a 10-year battle with cancer. He finally succumbed to it at the age of 61. We will miss him, but what a great body of work he left behind. According to sources, NBA players will not be required to get the COVID-19 vaccine. The NBA and the NBPA, their union, continue to negotiate aspects of COVID related protocols and procedures for the upcoming 2021-2022 season. But the NBPA, the Players Association, has refused to budge on its demand that players not be required to take the vaccine, according to sources. And any proposal that mandates vaccines remains a non-starter. Oh, you know we're going to have to talk about that another day. And guess who else is getting vaccines? The animals at the Brookfield Zoo here in Chicago. That's right. It turns out that human beings are not the only species on this panic, on this planet at risk for COVID-19. It's animals, and they're getting vaccinated at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo. Everybody, let's talk about what happened in California. Boy, oh boy, we were on pins and needles certainly last month when it looked like California Governor Gavin Newsom might lose. Well, it turns out that he did not, and he won going away. But what were the factors driving? What were the factors driving his win? Was it COVID? Some people are saying that his COVID policies helped drive people to the polls. Some people are saying that it was an excited Latinx electorate. Although he got the biggest share of the vote of people of color, is he got from black people, Dr. Malvo. No one's talking about that, but that's what he did get. And but was it Larry Elder? Did people just not like Larry Elder, who called for reparations to white people as opposed to black people? So we got a lot to talk about today, everybody. A lot to talk about. And I want to hear from you. 773-763-9278, 773-763-WCPT. A September 11th report from the LA Times. The headline is this: Democrats fight California recall, but say the party must do better. Don't just sit there. Apparently, there's a lot of unrest within the Democratic Party about what the party is and is not doing. What are they doing about climate change as the fires rage in California? What are they doing about economic inequality, homelessness, rising homicide rates in some cities, the pandemic's long-term economic toll? Yeah, all those things. It wasn't just COVID. It was a whole lot that was on the plate yesterday. So we've got this tremendous panel who are going to help us to work our way through this. We've got Dr. Julianne Malvo, President Emeritus of the Bennett College for Women, that iconic black college in Greensboro, North Carolina. She is now the Dean of Ethnic Studies at Cal State University and brilliant economist, MIT-trained economist. And, of course, we've got Wisconsin State Representative Lakeisha Myers. Now, we claim you in Chicago. I know Wisconsin got you, but you did used to work for Congressman Danny Davis. So we got you. We got you too, State Representative Myers, and best-selling author from Fair Vote, David Daley. Of course, Rat Eft, the true story of the secret plan to steal our democracy, and Unrigged, how Americans are battling back to save our democracy. Welcome to the show, everybody. John Nichols will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. Let me start with you, Dr. Julianne Malvo. You are a Californian, and now you're back in L.A. What happened yesterday? What is our takeaway?
Well, first of all, people, I won't say hated, they had great antipathy for Larry Elder. And I thought that brought a lot of people out to the polls. I think when we looked at the middle of August and we were looking at those lackluster numbers that Governor was getting, people, you know, the Democrats had not been ignited. Really, in small political circles, there was a lot of energy. But by and large, if you walked up and talked to someone, I talked to a student in the middle of August, and she's like, oh, I'm not into it. I got to get registered. I've got to get this done. Well, I ran into her yesterday, and she had the biggest grin. She said, you know, we did it. So when did she go from, I don't want to be bothered, to we did it? But I think a lot of people felt the same way. It was just one more thing. Of course, Elder is a very polarizing figure. Not only does he have the background of spousal or domestic abuse, but he also, one of my faculty members describes him as white supremacy in blackface. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what I would say about him. So black folks had great antipathy for him. Progressive white people had great antipathy for him. But what they had to do, and the strategy that Gavin had, I can call him Gavin, we go back. But the strategy that he had was a very, very risky, because they kept all credible Democrats off the ballot. So it was going to be Gavin or nobody, really.
Or Larry Elder. Or Larry field of thousands, right?
Yeah, the 46 people running on the other side. So it was a risky, I mean, anything could have happened, including, you know, Bubba the Fool being the governor of California. So, you know, the strategy was risky, but it worked. At the same time, it really did point to the flaws of the Democratic Party, the poor organizing, and then just the split between the progressive wing of the party and the more traditional wing of the party, because Governor Newsom is constantly challenged by the progressive wing of the party. They come out big droves to oppose him. He's had a Green Party candidate run against him, the gubernatorial. He had someone run against him as lieutenant governor. People just are not that the progressive wing wants it all. And, you know, spoken as a progressive who tips to the middle from time to time, the progressive wing can't have it all. The mainstream does not want the progressive wing to have it all. And so when we continue to see this nonsense with the progressive wing, it would have been many of them who caused the governor to have lost. Now, I'm excited about the Latino vote coming out. And, you know, the Latino population is the largest minority population here in California. Here in L.A., really almost not dominant, but has the potential to be dominant, certainly within the next 10 years. So it was delightful to see them come out for Gavin. But the question is, what's going to keep them coming out? And what is in it for them? Too many folks in that population don't vote regularly and don't see a reason to. And so that's the other, you know, the other piece of it. And then, of course, you know, this seems like it's so petty, and at some level it is. But at the same time, there were these unforced errors that the governor made, such as the French Laundry incident, which, of course, if listeners don't know, there's a very upscale restaurant in Napa Valley called the French Laundry, where the governor was spotted dining maskless with a bunch of people after he had told people, other people, to stay home.
It was a dinner table, full of his, he was out with his friends, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And he said it was a political contributor. Well, that doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. If you tell other people to stay home, you need to stay home yourself.
Because this was during the lockdown, was it not?
Yeah.
This was during the lockdown. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, and they had no business whatsoever doing that. It's no business. But, you know, some people think the rules don't apply to them. Hmm. And those people get recalled or get recall challenges. And the recall challenge cost the state over $200 million. And we're sitting here with an unhoused population just here in Los Angeles, 40,000 unhoused people, 40% of whom are African-American. So you look at the utter waste of money. You know, the governor has to be partly faulted. The Republicans probably won't do this anyway, because that's what Republicans do. We know that. We had Trump. But at the same time, what we do know is that the governor essentially added to his own woes with his own unforced errors. But it's a new day. He has another year and a half.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Next election will be November of 22. So not quite a year and a half, a year and a few months to reacquaint himself with the people of California and to basically hopefully eat a little humble pie and figure out some ways to energize the party. I mean, it's really energizing the Democratic Party. Democrats take too much for granted. I mean, we really do. And Democrats are not as progressive as they would have you believe they are.
They're not progressive.
And that's a problem.
Dr. Malvo, they're not progressive. They hew to the center and to the right. You know, that's been the fight that we've been in since the 80s with the Democrats. They would lurch right, even though the progressives were bringing the energy and the new voters to the party, right?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, the Democratic Party, in the 80s, I used to call them the Republicans and the Republicrats, because there was so little difference between them, really. Of course, the Republican Party has drifted all the way to the right with the, anti-tax, anti-spend, anti-human rights,
But the Democrats still push back on Bernie. They still push back on Elizabeth Warren. I mean, they continue to push back on progressives. And, you know, it's so unnecessary because it's because the party's still controlled, not by progressives. They bring in the numbers, they bring in the people, but it's still controlled by the centrists. It is.
Yeah, by the corporate Democrats,
corporate,
really.
Corporate Dems, absolutely.
Is what's going on. And those folks are not, what can I say? They're not progressive at all.
But stay right there. Let me go to David Daley. David Daley, author of the best-selling Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, or The True Story of the Secret Plan to Steal Your Democracy. And, of course, Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back, which is what we saw. Americans are battling back to save our democracy. What did you see yesterday? I mean, given all of given your deep understanding of what Republicans have been doing to take over state government and Congress, they said you can have the presidency, but we want all these other pieces. What did you make of yesterday's results or the whole fighting
everybody?
For this, for
I think that's a great question. I mean, I think what the recall really shows in many ways, if you look at it from that angle, is how determined Republicans are to find the levers that will allow them to hack electoral power, even in states where they do not have a majority. So in many states, that means gerrymandering, so that they can draw state legislative lines and control power even when they have fewer voters. In other states right now, Georgia, Arizona, Texas, you're seeing new voter suppression laws because those states are very, very close. And so a bunch of additional restrictions could tip the balance the other way. And in a state like California, where Democrats outnumber Republicans by 5 million voters, you can use a hack like a recall in which you only need 12% of the signatures of those who voted in the last gubernatorial election in order to have this crazy lower turnout off-season election in which somebody, if a recall is successful, can get elected with much less than 50% of the vote. You know, if Newsom had lost the recall vote, you would have had Larry Elder win at a much lower percentage than 50%. So Newsom needed to win with a higher number than the person who would have replaced him. And this is yet another Republican electoral hack. We are going to see this used again. I hope that Democrats in California use their power to come up with some means of reforming the recall so that it does not become a slap in the face to the idea of representative democracy. If you want to have a recall, politicians ought to be accountable to the people. Absolutely. California has a long history of this, but perhaps the lieutenant governor steps up. Perhaps you use ranked choice voting so that the person who gets elected is actually somebody who's got 50% support of the vote. Something has to happen there. But Republicans, Newsom, I think, was successful in thwarting this recall because he was able to nationalize this race. He was able to make it less of a referendum on himself than a choice between himself or Larry Elder / Donald Trump. And that is a very effective argument to make in California. But if Democrats think that that is an effective argument for them to make in all of these swing states next year, in the Georgia Senate races, in the Arizona governor's race, in key governor's races and Secretary of State contests in places like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, I think they're going to have more to run on themselves. That might have been an effective strategy in 2018 when Republicans controlled government and Donald Trump was in charge. The Democrats could say, we're not them. But in 2022, they will have had power for the previous 2 years, all of the power in Washington, in Congress, and in the White House. They're going to have a record. They're going to have to, as you say, do better and show what they're willing to do in office, not just say we're not those guys.
Wisconsin State Representative, I need your help, because I mean this did become a national race for all of us. Lakeisha Myers, this has been a national race. What did it mean to you? I mean, because you're not only a Wisconsinite, you're also a Chicagoan. I mean, and you know Congress, you know state government, you know politics inside out, from the bottom up, from the top down. I've got 2 minutes, and I'm going to let you speak some more when we get on the other side of the break. What did this recall race mean to you?
I think it was exactly right. He said it was a referendum vote, but you were able to nationalize that. But I also think that this was the new Republican playbook. When you go back and look at the strategies of trying to utilize recall elections, we know traditionally recalls don't work. What they do is open up the door for doubt. And it is the strategy to get fewer people to vote, but then Republicans usually can win elections that way. That is something that has always happened, especially when you look at a state that is in trouble like Wisconsin. When you look at a lot of different states that will be having gubernatorial elections, this is going to be the new pathway forward. And then you get people who are so far right, like,
State Representative Myers, we got you in a bad spot. You know what? Stay right there, because I want you to go into greater depth on the other side of the break. We're going to have one of your fellow Wisconsinites is going to be with us, John Nichols. But I want to hear from you, because there's real tension between the Democrats and the Republicans, between the progressive populist tradition and the right-wing tradition in Wisconsin. It's a real fight that we've seen play out with your governors, with your runaway senators, Lena, and company. You know, it's real. This is something, as you point out, that happens, that is happening all over the country. And I think we need to pay attention. And I want you kind of to tie it into your experience with working with one of the greatest congressmen we'll ever know, Congressman Danny Davis, who's a real man of the streets. I'm so glad that he was able to get into Congress so he could finally get paid for the work that he was doing for free. Congressman, state representative. Because he was doing everything he does in Congress now. He was doing it for free for years and years and years. He wasn't thinking about a pension or anything like that. We love you, Congressman Danny Davis. Stay right here with more of the Santita Jackson Show. I want to know what you think about what happened in California. And don't think they've stopped. Can't stop. Don't stop. Won't stop. It's not over. Back in just a minute. Santita Jackson Show.
Everyone, we can change the world. Change the world. Change the world.
Oh, yes, we can.
We can change the world. We can change the world. Change the world.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
War and hate to a place of love. It's not too late. Gotta save the children. We can't wait. Let's change the world.
Everybody, welcome back to the Santita Jackson Show. We're talking about the California recall. What did it mean to California, to Californians? What does it mean to us nationally? Is this a page out of the Republican playbook? Because, I mean, they're taking over state governments, and they are winning by challenging election nullification. They are winning offices. I don't know if they're helping the Republic at all. They're not. The Democracy, no, they're not. But that's how they're playing it. That's how they're playing it. And up to last month, Dr. Malveaux pointed out, you know, we did not know whether Gavin Newsom was going to win or not. That's why they had to bring Vice President Harris in, first African-American to hold statewide office in the state of California. Former senator, former attorney general, all of that. Then you had to bring in President Biden. You had to bring in Elizabeth Warren. You had to bring Auntie Maxine Waters, up and down the state. You had to do everything you could. And I will say, let me give props to the black community. Even though they're 7% of the electorate, they gave him more than 80% of their vote, which is a greater percentage than any other group gave to Gavin Newsom. And he needed every single vote, even though he won by 64% of the vote. We've got Dr. Julian Malveaux, brilliant economist, MIT trained, the president emeritus of the historic Bennett College for Women out of Greensboro. She is now the dean of ethnic studies at Cal State Los Angeles. So excited to have her. We've got John Nichols. national correspondent for The Nation magazine, brilliant author, podcaster, broadcaster, all of that. Before we get to you, John Nichols, we've been talking with your fellow Wisconsinite, State Representative Lakeisha Myers, about what she's seeing on a practical level, because, of course, you know, as a legislator, when you've had these right-wing, you don't get moderate Republicans who head up your government. You always get these union busters in. The people are far to the right. I mean, I remember meeting State Senator Lena Taylor in Reverend's office because they had run away from the state.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy. Representative Myers, before I go to you, John, I mean, when you looked at California, what were you thinking was going to happen? What were you afraid was going to happen? What are you happy that happened?
I was afraid that turnout was going to be low. That was the first thing I thought. I said, if the base, as Dr. Malvo said, has not been activated for Democrats, that always spells trouble for us. So I was happy to see that all of the efforts went into, even though I thought it was kind of 11th hour, when you look at the exit polls that were there a month before, turnout is key for Democrats to win. And Republicans know that. And they are utilizing and trying to get a ground game together that will diminish turnout for Democrats in, you know, midterm elections. This is pretty much where we are. We know that people pay attention to four-year elections. They pay attention to the presidential. However, they don't pay attention to a lot of the state house races that happen in quote-unquote off years. They don't pay attention to a lot of gubernatorial elections unless you have high commercial turnout. So I think that's something that we have to look at. Also looking at the effects of redistricting, Wisconsin is most definitely a state that has redistricting disease with gerrymandering being involved. I already know of people that have been drawn out of their district at the municipal level and at the county level. I'm waiting to see what happens, you know, at the state level for us, because that's the only way that in Wisconsin they are able to have such a wide reach. And that's because we've not been in control to help draw these lines or even have any equitable type of drawing system in the state of Wisconsin. So I think that is the long-term the game for the Republican Party, is trying to do this. Also looking at the splinters. Dr. Malvo talked earlier about the splinters in both the Democratic Party and I will say even in the Republican Party. You mentioned, Santita, that there were very few moderate Republicans that are left in office. That is very, very true. So this is something that is very polarizing. You either have people that are going to be all the way left or all the way right. I think we're seeing that play out in the Capitol right now when you talk about the For the People Act and you talk about the fact that voting rights has still not been passed yet. Comprehensive voting rights package, all of that is happening now. That goes to what you were talking about earlier with having a record to stand on, because whether you are considered a progressive in the Democratic Party or not, you want some type of comprehensive reform to take place because we are in trouble otherwise. And if we don't have that, I feel sorry for a lot of people in my party because it's not going to go well, especially not with black folks, especially not with the history that we have of, you know, having to, you know, basically stand in line to vote on other people's property, having people look over our shoulders to vote, having gerrymandering, you know, dilute our vote. It's not going to be good.
Seems like a national problem to me. Absolutely. Before I go to you, John, Dr. Malvo, very quickly, what is the black vote a factor in California state politics? We know it is in urban politics, but just broad. Well, let me know. In urban politics, suburban,
certainly,
rural,
yeah,
state politics.
Well, certainly the black vote is a factor in urban politics because we're so disproportionately concentrated in urban areas. Mm-hmm. It's interesting if you look at the map of California and which counties went for the governor and which went the other way. You just go down the coast, literally just go down the coast, and basically that's where the Democratic votes are. Some of those places, L.A., San Francisco, have significant black population. Others are relatively rural. the black folks are a political factor because of our representative nature. In other words, most people think black and they think progressive, or at least democratic. And so the fact that Elder got spanked really puts basically a lie to the trope that black people will just vote for black people mindlessly. I mean, black people did not vote for Larry Elder.
Dr. Malvo, come on.
Pardon?
Reparations to white people?
Oh, yeah. White slaveholders. That, you know, that man is, well, I'm going to keep it civil this morning.
Well, keep it civil.
And just say,
we already know. His record speaks for himself. But, you know, they're saying now that this effectively, the Republican Party has become his. Stay right there, Dr. Malvo, because your analysis is just brilliant. John Nichols. Now, you know, you said yesterday, you said, I believe, Gavin Newsom, you said he's turned, no, you said definitively, he's turned a corner, I think he's going to make it. Huh. He did. What happened between August and now? Because last month, it was not a given that he was going to survive this recall.
Not at all. It was, in fact, there was a real possibility that Gavin Newsom could have lost. And the key to this thing, and I think that Representative Myers is referencing this very well, as all of your panel, the key to this thing is that Republicans try to game the system. They try to game the system at the front end and at the back end. They look for the vulnerabilities where they may be able to achieve a very low turnout election in which their base is excited and engaged. But the base of the Democratic candidate is not excited and engaged. And that was their whole vision with this recall election. They wanted to keep it high energy with their base and then off radar with everybody else. What changed in August was that Larry Elder stepped up. And the fascinating thing as regards Larry Elder stepping up is that he had not been anticipated as a potential candidate early on. There was a bunch of other people running, very, you know, not particularly prominent Republicans, a former mayor, a former candidate who had been defeated badly, et cetera. Larry Elder stepped up as someone who was prominent, who did have a record, who was known, and frankly, who was a very capable communicator. And the end result was he became instantaneously the opponent. And the national right-wing media, Fox News, other institutions, they loved this. They loved to have somebody they could put up and bring on nightly and highlight and emphasize. The problem was for the Republicans in this case, suddenly this recall, which is a very complex mechanism, two votes, one on whether you like Newsom or not, and then another on who you would replace him. Suddenly it became a normalized election. You had Gavin Newsom running against Larry Elder. There are all these other candidates, but that clarity of the race changed, I believe, changed just about everything. And it brought out, it gave people a reason to vote. It gave a focus to this whole thing. Then when you combine that with very strong organizing, I think you ended up with a situation that actually, you know, it's complicated to say this, but in many ways it benefited Gavin Newsom, not just in this moment, but it may have benefited him in the longer term. Because he got to run very clearly against someone, another candidate, to, in the image of the voters, the eyes of the media as well, to win very big. So I think in this case, the Republican strategy sort of blew up on the Republicans. But it is important to understand that they'll keep working this strategy. They'll keep looking for these openings where they can, again, keep it low turnout on the side of the Democratic base, to make it high turnout on the side of the Republican base. They'll use voter suppression. They'll use strategies focused on, you know, election rules that will benefit them. Obviously, money, whatever else, whatever can make this work. Because at this point, especially in states like California, but increasingly around the country, Republicans recognize that they are now a minority party. They are not capable of winning a majority of the votes, not with the issues they're running on. They might well remake themselves and become quite capable. But in this circumstance, they're not. And so their strategy has to be to go for these very low turnout elections on the other side, high turnout on theirs. And frankly, to be very satisfied with ruling, with governing as a minority party. They have no problem with that. They're not trying to build a grand coalition. They're not trying to go big. They are trying to go small. It blew up on them in California, but you should not for a second anticipate that that this strategy won't continue to play out. And the last thing that I'll note in this regard, there's been a lot of talk about the black vote in California. It's important to understand, and I know that the people on your panel understand this, and I expect many of your listeners do as well, but I'll restate it just because it may be of some value. The California black community has been well organized and political for a long time. It was always going to be the base for Gavin Newsom in this election. And that's because people, you go all the way back to Mayor Bradley in L.A. to Wilson Riles, the first black elected official, statewide elected official in California, to his son, Wilson Riles Jr., who was Santita, Northern California chair, I think, for your father's campaign. Mm-hmm. I believe in 84 and active in 88. All of these folks and so many others, Maxine Waters, Yvonne Breakwith Burke, years and years of organizing. And so this is an important thing to understand. In California, because there's so many new folks arriving, so much transition, such a changing state in so many ways, the core of the vote for Democratic candidates, at least in recent decades, has been the black vote. And this is why Republicans have spent so much time trying to suppress the black vote. Not so much in California, they don't have the ability to do that, but in so many states around the country, because it is because of this sort of history, this history of long-term organizing and political engagement. And it's something we have to be conscious of as regards California and states across the country.
I'd like to put Dr. Malvo in that. She's one of she's been with my family since she was a teenager, and she was one of our key and early organizers, along with Barbara Lee, in California, in Northern California in 1983 and 1984. Mm-hmm. She's one of the people who pushed Reverend over the edge and made him run. Because what is not known is that Reverend was trying to get Maynard Jackson or Andrew Young to run, because he said, you are more mainstream and you will, you'll resonate better with the white community than I do. But the grassroots, there was a people's draft. They made him run, and there you have it. Let me go to Renee from the West Side. Renee, what's on your mind today? I mean, you are beginning to call in a lot. Renee, I love it. What's going
on? Thank you. Good morning. Hey. I'm glad that you love it. Okay, I just want to say, in response to Dr. Malvo's statement about progressives want it all, the fact is, and well, my opinion is that we just want something. We keep getting denied the things that we asked for. We just want that dream of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We want to have clean air. We want to have jobs. We want to have health care. We want to have the basic needs that people in other countries have and what we can afford to give everybody in this country. We shouldn't have homeless people. I'm driving my grandbaby to school today. She just got off her nebulizer that she has to do every morning. She has to do a vest every morning, too, to pump her lungs. What's going to happen when she turns 26 and she won't be on her mother's insurance and stuff? Mm-hmm. Nobody should have to worry about whether or not they'll have access to good medical care. That should be a basic human right. And this country, this rich country who spends so much money on war, they could afford to make sure everybody has good health care. They could make sure everybody has a good education, has access to education, has access to housing, has access to clean air and clean water, basic things. So we don't want everything. We do want something, especially the basics. And if the Democrats would do that for the people, they wouldn't have to worry about elections, because Republicans would be drawn to their party. People would be drawn to somebody that they can see is actually trying to do stuff to help them. not just talk.
Well, stay right there, Renee. Because one of the rabble-rousers, one of the rabble-rousing progressives that I have known has always been Dr. Julian Malvo. But, you know, I think that as we get older, we also see some other things, because from being a student leader to being a college president, that's quite a journey, right? Winning your way through the system, you know, getting a PhD is not an easy thing, but getting an in economics from MIT, you know, they didn't want her in there. You know, they didn't want her there. So she's seen a lot of things in how you kind of have to sometimes bend. And I don't want to speak for you, Dr. Malvo, but why don't you respond to what you've heard from Renee, who is one of the most esteemed teachers that we have in our public school system. And our children have gone on to be stellar students and professionals following her example.
Well, I look forward to meeting Renee sometime when we get back to not normal, but pre-COVID, and we're able again at the Rainbow to have our Push Excel breakfast with you. I have
Renee's
so many
one of the
titles,
people who needs,
I don't mean
needs
that,
to be
but
in
I am
on the organizing,
Push
Dr. Malvo,
which does give me joy.
She needs to be in on
Renee,
the organizing.
Renee, what I would say to you, Renee, is this. I'm as progressive as they come, but I'm also as pragmatic as they come. And the pragmatic is what we have. I mean, sometimes I think that we Democrats are just committed to shooting ourselves in the foot. Nancy Pelosi is far from perfect. She was my congressperson when I lived in San Francisco, and she is someone that I know very well. That anti-Pelosi sort of thing, when she's one of the most skilled legislators that you will meet, that anti-Pelosi thing was not useful. It really was not useful. It allowed some people to stake out their claim that they, Hakeem Jeffries, some others, that they were the next generation of leadership. But when you've got a margin of 3 or 4 votes in the Congress, and you have all the things we've just seen here in California, but other places, we've got a bloodbath looming for 2022 unless we do something about it. And attacking Pelosi ain't gonna get it.
Yeah, but you
know, I don't think she's a permanent fixture.
No, she's not.
Lots of people who are nipping at her heels. But I do think that we have to be more tactical as Democrats.
I think
that's all
I'm
saying.
But
I mean, I want progressives to have it all too. I mean, I've written, much of my work has gone into writing about what a progressive economy looks like, how people can get all the things that you mentioned, from the health care to the education. And certainly after we blew, I don't know how many trillion dollars in Afghanistan, the low estimate is $2 trillion, and a higher estimate is something around $15 trillion. When we blew all that money, I mean, just blew it, and what do we have to show for it? Certainly, we can make the argument that the money is there, that the money for clean energy is there.
All of it.
But
we can afford that.
But see, sure, we're not going to get it all at one time. Let's just
be
real
clear. But this is
We have no margin in the Senate, and we have Joe Manchin.
But the problem blue dog Democrats, because the corporate Democrats, they never stop. And some of them are personal friends of mine, but I disagree with their politics. Absolutely. That's what I think. I don't want to speak for you, Renee, but that's what I see.
Uh-huh.
And that bothers me when Barbara Lee is in line to be a leader and she gets undercut by a black member of Congress who is a centrist.
Exactly.
I'm not mad at him. No, I am. But I like him a lot. But I was like, Hakeem, why'd you do that to Barbara Lee? Stop.
Well, Santita,
so
I'm mad.
Wait a minute. It was so awful that Nancy Pelosi had to create a leadership position for her, because it was like, come on. She got jammed here. Oh. I mean, by the person that AOC defeated. He linked up with the guy who AOC defeated. Oh, come on.
Bothers me.
Go on, Renee, before we go.
Oh, no, I was just wanting to say, lastly, that it also bothers me to see how much money so many members of Congress, including Democrats, have invested in these pharmaceutical companies that shows that they have a conflict of interest. Are they looking out for the people, or are they looking out for the dividends that they get from their stocks? And If you see stuff like that going on, it makes you suspicious about the Democrats and about the Republicans. and it turns people off. And that's a lot of black people are looking at Republicans.
Well, and they are, and that I think that's a mistake. But you know what? The thing is, I think no matter what the party, you've got to press people to do what you need them to do. Let me go to Wisconsin State Representative Lakeisha Myers. I've got about less than a minute. Why don't you speak to Renee and what? Give us a little education on what we need to do as constituents to get what we need, so that we can help you help us when you get to the state capitol and to Washington.
Realistically, I think making your voices heard. I'm on point with Dr. Malvo when you talk about the internal squabbles can lose us the war. And I think that's what we all have to look at. And Rome wasn't built in a day. We didn't get to this position in a day. You can't expect that, you know, I understand youth and vigor because I'm one of the youngest members to serve, you know, in the state house. I guess I'm not the youngest now. I'm kind of in the middle of the pack now at 37. But when you look at pragmatism and looking at how elections are won and looking at process, a lot of times people want things very quickly, but they don't understand the process and the nuance that goes into that. I think that was interesting when you go back to the whole conversation about Auntie Maxine saying, reclaiming my time. Mm-hmm. She knew process in that moment, whereas, you know, then Senator Harris was able to say something different. It didn't have the same effect. Mm-hmm. So when you understand what the playbook is, you have to understand what you have the ability to do. And I think that's where a lot of our progressive members get in trouble. We kind of go in hot shot, you know, we're going to make our own connections and do what we want to do, do it our way and do it quickly. And it does not work well. You
and
can't
burn
have
bright.
Enemies in your own camp.
Well, and
you
we
can't burn,
bright, burn
down
you burn out.
Your own camp.
Well, you're
That's right.
right.
You burn out and you fizzle very quickly.
You flame out spectacularly, and that becomes a problem. So I think that Dr. Malvo is still a firebrand, but she is like, you know, when you cross, go through the looking glass, it's a little different. The people, there is something, there are people who have been there, and you've got to work with them. I think we would be well served to talk to Maxine Waters, who has been in local and state government. Willie Brown has been the kingmaker in California politics.
You have
and
to learn need, from them, too. That's
you
the
have
thing.
To learn from them. They have much to teach you. Maxine Waters is in her 80s. She has a lot to teach us, a lot to tell us. Dr. Malvo and State Representative Lakeisha Myers and John Nichols, please stay with me and give some closing thoughts on the other side on the Santita Jackson and Friends page. Everybody like and share, like and share, like and share. And please, if you want to hear the podcast of this show, go to WCPT820.com/Santita. WCPT820.com/Santita. I am so grateful to you, Dr. Malvo, for all of the work that you have been doing down through the years. President Emeritus of Bennett College for Women. I'm firebrand politically. You never lost that fire. MIT-trained economist. And now the Dean of Ethnic Studies at Cal State Los Angeles. They are so fortunate to have you. The brilliant John Nichols, national correspondent for The Nation magazine, brilliant podcaster, author, all of that. And the baby of the bunch, Wisconsin State Representative Lakeisha Myers. Now she's the old young person. Girl, you better be quiet. Stay right here, everybody. Gonna get some closing thoughts here on Santita Jackson and Friends. God willing, I'll be with you tomorrow. God bless. Family, are you-